The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org.
On Tuesday, April 15th, 2008, members of New Beginnings, a nonpartisan policy study group made up of former senior U.S. officials, academics, and other experts on Korea, released their recommendations for updating and strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance at a press conference at the Korea Society in New York City.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Korea Society. I'm Evans Revere, the president of the Korea Society, and we're delighted to have you here this morning. I guess folks are going to continue to file in, and we're waiting for one more panelist. We're actually not going to wait for one more panelist. We'll go ahead and start, and hopefully Ambassador Hubbard will join us momentarily. This is, of course, a very important day in U.S.-Korea relations. We have President Lee Myung-bak arriving shortly in New York for his first visit as president to the United States, and we're delighted at the Korea Society to be a part of that visit. We'll be hosting President Lee and his delegation later on this evening for a black tie event where he'll be the keynote speaker, and I'm sure he'll have some extremely important things to say regarding the U.S.-Korea relationship. And we thought that this would be a valuable opportunity for us to release the report that I think all of you have in your hands right now, a report that the Korea Society and the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center have been working on for several months. We started this project late last year. We've had a group of very distinguished Americans, most of whom have extensive experience in Korea or dealing with Korea, working on this project for several months. We had an opportunity to spend a few days in Seoul and meet with the president-elect and his leadership team a few weeks back. And what you have before you is the product of our efforts. And the panel today will talk for a few minutes about their impressions of our visit and the contents of this report, which I commend to you. We had an event in Washington yesterday where we had an opportunity to begin this process of rolling out this this report, and you may have seen some of the reporting in the Korean press about that event. This morning, I'm joined with a number of very distinguished friends and colleagues, whom I think will be very familiar to you. On my far right is Ambassador Mike Armacost, who is currently the Shorenstein Distinguished Fellow at Stanford University, but of course he was also a former United States Ambassador to both Japan and the Philippines, and also the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. On my immediate left is Gyuk Shin, who is a good friend and colleague and known to all of you, I think, here, who is, of course, the director of the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center. And he and I have been the co-chairs of this project. And seated to my immediate right is a very familiar face to all of you, Ambassador Tom Hubbard, who is currently with McLarty Associates and, of course, was also U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Korea and to the Philippines. And then last and hardly least, a good friend and colleague and former State Department colleague of mine who's currently at the Shorenstein Center, David Straub, who gets special kudos for his tremendous role in putting this report together and doing a lot of the heavy lifting that made it possible. I thought what I would just do is just give you a few of my own personal comments and reflections, and then ask Gyuk to come in with his thoughts on the process that we've been through, and then invite the panelists to do the same, and then open it up for questions and comments by all of you. As I mentioned at the outset, this is an important day in this relationship, and it'll be an important week in this relationship, ending up with a summit between Presidents Lee and Bush at Camp David. This is, of course, the first time that a sitting Korean president has had the opportunity to meet President Bush, a U.S. president, at Camp David, and I think the significance of that is tremendous indeed. This is a critically important relationship, and all of us, as we launched this project a few months ago, were reflecting on how important and how much growing importance there is to the U.S.-ROK relationship, a relationship which is one of the linchpins of the American security posture in Asia in general and Northeast Asia in particular. That relationship is made all the more important by the fact that Northeast Asia is going through a period of dynamic change with a rising China and other factors. It's a tremendously economically successful region, becoming even more so. And in that sense, it's critically important to America's economic security as well. And so this is a relationship that not only has an important security dimension, but an important economic dimension as well, and both of those are growing on a day-by-day basis. But in recent years, as you know, the United States and our South Korean partner have gone through a bit of a rough patch in the relationship. We've been through a very complicated period, a period whose complications have been driven in part by some differences over policy, particularly policy with respect to North Korea, by an unfortunate incident that took place during a U.S. military exercise a few years ago in Korea and the strong public reaction to that in Korea in the aftermath of that accident, and by a perception on the part of some in recent years that there was this sense of drift in the relationship and that there were growing audiences in both countries that were not as committed to the relationship as they once were. I think the very good news is that we've managed to put most of that bad patch behind us. I think there's been a lot of hard work done by Americans and Koreans, officials in both capitals, some of whom are in this room today, who have done a superb job under difficult circumstances in putting the relationship back on what I think is a very good and strong track. And I think additional good news is that the period, the darkest period perhaps in the U.S.-ROK relationship in recent years when there was an outburst of anti-American sentiment is behind us at this point. I think if you look at public opinion polling in South Korea, if you talk to newspaper editors, if you talk to Korean government officials, you do get the sense that we have moved beyond this period and that the future of our relationship is once again back on a positive track, which I think is very encouraging. We do have, of course, a new president in Korea, and as we were reflecting on this project a few months ago, we realized that the accession of a new president in South Korea and the fact that the United States will have a new president in a few months' time opened up an opportunity for the United States and the Republic of Korea to renew, revitalize, and reemphasize the importance of our bilateral relationship and to work to expand it, to work to extend it, and to work to deepen it in some interesting and creative new ways. And that's, in essence, what this report is all about. I think if you look at the summary that we've given you, it indicates several areas that we've focused on in particular, areas such as creating a true global partnership between the United States and the Republic of Korea, working to iron out issues in our security alliance, and working to expand and enhance the way we work together in the security sphere, working to harmonize our respective positions on North Korea, which, as I mentioned, has been one of the difficulties that we've had in recent years. As I've said in introducing this report to other audiences, though, this is not a report about North Korea. It's a report about the U.S.-ROK alliance, which is the centerpiece of United States relations with the Korean Peninsula. But North Korea is sort of like a cloud, if you will, that sort of hangs over every aspect of the U.S.-ROK relationship, and it's something that we obviously have to contend with. The report also deals in a very forthright way with economic and trade issues between our two countries and makes a very strong argument for the importance of the ratification of the free trade agreement, which is currently pending both in the National Assembly in Korea and in the United States Congress. And then finally, the report talks about the critical importance of people-to-people ties between the United States and the ROK. This is a dimension that often does not get as much attention as it should. When you consider the number of Korean Americans living in the United States today, when you consider the range and depth of exchanges that go on between our two countries, this is a dimension that we wanted to focus some attention on in this report, because it has the potential to make a very significant contribution to shaping the future of the U.S.-ROK relationship. I said it yesterday, and I'll say again today, that I've always been of the opinion that the best days of the U.S.-ROK relationship have not yet been seen. They are ahead of us still. And I think we do have a tremendous opportunity with new leadership in Seoul, with current leadership here in Washington and future leadership in Washington, to move this relationship onto a new and stronger and an even better plane than it has been on in the past. So there is a tremendous opportunity ahead of us, and a tremendous opportunity, as the title of our report shows, to launch our relationship in terms of new beginnings, using this this term to reaffirm and reinvigorate the relationship. Having made those opening comments, let me invite my my co-chair, Gyuk Shin, to make a few opening comments as well.
Okay, thanks, Evans. It's my great honor and pleasure to be here this morning. And I know this is a big day for Korea society, so thanks for hosting this event in your busy schedule. As Evans mentioned already, last year, about this time, we were thinking about U.S.-Korea alliance, and we thought that 2008 could be a very important opportunity for both countries, because South Korea will have new government, and then fairly soon we will have new government as well in the United States. Okay, therefore, we are trying to assess what has happened in South Korea and trying to make some recommendation to U.S. policymakers. As a subtitle in the report says, we are basically making recommendations to U.S. policymakers. I mean, there has been a similar project like this, but then oftentimes they include both Korean and American experts. But this time we intentionally only included American experts. Oftentimes I have my own identity crisis because I'm from Korea, but now I'm teaching at American University and I'm American citizen, so I'm representing, I guess, American experts, but whenever I go back to Korea, I have some identity issue. But anyway, so we are trying to make a recommendation to American policymakers. And our plan is that we wanted to keep this group, at least for the time being, and then after new government takes place in the United States, we can assess policy issues here, and then we can make recommendations to Korean policymakers. We are hoping that by this time next year, we can issue different reports. Okay, now, as a background, let me say two things. First one, I think there are two images of South Korea or alliance in the United States. One is, quote-unquote, golden age of the alliance, mostly during authoritarian years, in which, I guess, South Korea was more or less willing to follow American leadership. South Korea was much more hesitant to make their own voice. That's, I think, one image. The other one, just opposite, is probably 2002, when anti-American movement were very strong, and then they played out during presidential election. So that was probably the first time that anti-American movements were linked to institutional politics. So I think, you know, that's maybe the other opposite. But in our view, neither correctly captures what Korea is today. You know, certainly, Korea has changed a lot for last maybe 20 years in the post-Cold War, post-authoritarian year. And it's very important for American policymakers to understand, you know, what has happened and changed in Korea. In other words, we have to understand Korea as is today, not as was in the past. So we had a meeting late January at Stanford, and then we went on to Korea to meet with Mr. Lee, president-elect at the time, and his senior advisors. We also met a lot of people, you know, opposition leaders, military experts. You know, Mr. An, we met in Korea over here today. And, you know, business leaders, academics, journalists, policy experts, and so on. So as Evans mentioned, the report is the outcome of these meetings. Okay, let me close my remarks by making one statement. You know, I cannot agree more with Evans and other colleagues that this is a great opportunity. And then there's a lot of optimism for the future of alliance. But I'd like to make also a little cautious note because, you know, there's optimism and we have to be optimistic, but that doesn't mean there's no challenge. You know, we are facing a lot of challenges as well. I'm sure my colleague will be talking more about details, but like, you know, FTA is one challenge. Still, North Korean issue hasn't been resolved. So, in order to capitalize on this great opportunity, we have to work to make that happen. We have to work to produce more constructive relationship between two countries. Okay, therefore, we have to be a little cautious in creating too much expectation or unwarranted optimism. But at the same time, we have to work to make this opportunity into a reality of better relationship between two countries. So I'm going to stop here, then I'll be happy to entertain any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Giuk. Before turning to my other colleagues for comments, I would just note, apropos this this good advice from Giuk about the need for optimism but caution at the same time, I was reading through the Korean media this morning, and I noticed that the Republic of Korea's most conservative paper and the Republic of Korea's most liberal newspaper both carried editorials this morning complaining that the United States was in danger of making excessive demands of Korea. And that's a theme that's actually noted in our report about the need to proceed forward, but to proceed forward keeping in mind the reality of contemporary Korea. And I thought it was rather ironic that just before we sat down here this morning, we were reading editorials from both the left and the right saying pretty much the same thing as we say in our report this morning. Having said that, let me invite my colleagues, perhaps beginning with Ambassador Armacost, to make some comments, and then I'll ask Ambassador Hubbard, and then David Straub, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you. I share the enthusiasm and the optimism and the caution that have been expressed already. I may be unique on this group because I've never had the privilege of working and living in Korea or learning the Korean language, but I've been involved for nearly 40 years in policy that relates to the Korean Peninsula, so I have a great personal stake in how things go. My experience taught me the alliance is of extraordinary importance, and that with Korea's growth, the trade between us is of great importance to the prosperity of both countries. In my recollection, the halcyon days were somewhere else. I mean, we had a relationship which was of great importance, but it was never very easy. I mean, there were always big bilateral problems, and they always got managed because our interests converged and because there was a deep reservoir of goodwill on both sides, particularly among people who dealt with the relationship officially, and because there was a sense of common danger. And if we've had trouble in the last decade, I think it's in part because the perceptions of North Korea affected the attitudes toward the necessity for the alliance and the way the alliance should work. And I take my hat off to those who worked in both our governments. I have not in recent years, despite those differences in perception, at working to modernize the alliance, getting the force deployment issues in shape, and negotiating a trade agreement, which I think would be of great benefit to both countries. And with the election of President Lee, whom I just met for the first time in February, my optimism has grown because the perception gap has been substantially narrowed. To have a Korean president affirming the importance of the alliance, of insisting upon reciprocity in dealings with the North, in seeking engagement with the North, but withholding some of the big economic concessions until progress is made on the denuclearization issue, and on lending his business experience to fortifying further growth in the Korean Peninsula. It seems to me those are all good things that make it easier to have the kind of tone at the top of the relationship that's important. I see three particular challenges that we have in taking advantage of the opportunity. First, in dealing with the North, it has always been my conviction that we didn't have much of a North Korean policy unless it fit comfortably and converged nicely with South Korea. South Korea, from our standpoint, is the strategic prize on the peninsula, and we can't afford to get at odds with the most important half of that peninsula. And so I've been nervous in recent years as we've worked at cross-purposes often in the six-party talks, and therefore in a way have nullified one another's efforts. It seems to me we've tended to forget at times, as our negotiations have focused more specifically on dealing with North Korea on this nuclear issue, that we're not likely to make real progress, durable progress, unless we can present a united front with South Korea and Japan and China. And the first important, most important task is to coordinate that approach with Seoul and to draw Japan back in through trilateral discussions and then get Chinese on board. I think those priorities have been confused of late, and sometimes we appear to be talking to the North and then catching up with our allies later. I haven't discussed this so much with the Korean officials, but I've gotten a big blowback from Japanese officials who feel they're not being consulted in candor and in a timely way. So that's a kind of a warning flag, it seems to me, for how we should begin to reconstruct the sort of consultative approach and unified approach that I think is necessary to make headway. North Koreans, after all, are very skillful at spotting the seams between their interlocutors and exploiting those to buy time and to drive wedges between their neighbors and the United States. The second, this trade issue, I think, is extremely important because it offers benefits to both countries. I've seen, as our report mentions, the Korean economists acknowledge that the U.S. might even achieve greater benefits on the export side. Korea might achieve particular benefits in using that agreement to accelerate its own liberalization and opening to the world and spur its own competitiveness. But I must say it's very discouraging for someone who now lives on the West Coast to come back to Washington and listen to the way people talk about trade. And to listen to the politicians, you would think trade was a gift that we bestow on others or a weapon that we wield against others. It's actually a set of transactions which enable our citizens to benefit. And to the extent we curtail or we don't maximize those opportunities to trade, we're curtailing the freedom of our own people. But somehow the logic of trade has gotten lost in our debate. And with the politicians pandering to the labor unions, it's a pretty tough year to move these things through the Congress. My anxiety, as I expressed yesterday to some friends in Washington, is that the temptation will be to kick the problem down the road, say, let's get through our politics, we'll take it up next year. The first years of new administration are not always very orderly times. New administration comes in. Whoever is elected next year will be new. They have to recruit a team. They have to get their teams confirmed. They have to set their priorities. They have to establish their relations with Congress. They have to get their ducks in a row. They often make mistakes. They always encounter unexpected problems. So to count on being able to tee this up early next year isn't something I would count on. And it's the reason why I hope that we can find a window still, despite the politics of our nomination process, to get this done. It's a good agreement. The work has been done. I feel confident Koreans will do what's needed to get the beef issue resolved. We'll get it ratified, and I hope there will be a window sometime later this year before our elections where we can get the business finished, because I worry about kicking it too far down the road. Third problem is the question of synchronizing our politics. Part of the difficulty in recent years has been Korea's had its most liberal administration. We've had our most conservative, and they were kind of boats passing in the night. Korea's moved back in a more conservative direction. It's not quite clear yet how our politics will work out this year, but the odds are we're moving in the other direction. So I'm hoping that on our side we do what's necessary to be sure that whomever comes in next November recognizes the importance of this relationship, recognizes that there are a lot of things that are teed up, so someone can hit a drive right down the middle of the fairway if they're smart enough to take advantage of the opportunity, and that we won't wind up going off in opposite directions again. Anyway, those are the things I worry about.
Thank you very much for those good comments, particularly the golf metaphor, which speaks loudly to some of us in this room in particular. One thing that really struck me that I just wanted to underscore based on the comments that Ambassador Armacost just made is the importance of this issue of trilateral consultation and coordination in dealing with North Korea. It's not just a U.S.-ROK bilateral issue, in our view. It's also important to bring the Japanese in and to make sure that our approach going forward is carefully coordinated with all the critical players, our two key allies in Northeast Asia, that often doesn't get emphasized as much as it should in public, and it's one of the centerpieces of this report. Let me now turn the floor over to Ambassador Hubbard.
Thank you very much, Evans. As one who almost never hits the ball straight down the fairway, I hesitate.
Don't believe
to
that.
Follow on my Armacost good comments. I think his commentary was very apt. I think his policy recommendations and his concerns were all very appropriate, and I can only endorse that. I'd like to just make a couple of points. One is that we've chosen the title "New Beginnings" for the work of this group, and I hope no one interprets that as somehow we're rejecting what has gone on in the past. As Evans has said, we have gone through a rough patch. I think. Resulting in from the difficulties of the North Korea problem and some of the differing perceptions we have in the two countries. We've had some terrible accidents that have affected the relationship. But I do want to recognize that in this 10 years of center left government in Korea, some good things have happened. Obviously, we still have a long way to go on North Korea. I don't think we've yet got the right mix of engagement and you know, carrots and sticks and pressure. But I hate to think where we would be now if Kim Dae-jung had not taken his initiatives to lower the temperature on the Korean Peninsula to engage with the North. And I think because of that, we have a basis for moving forward now. I think also Kim Dae-jung deserves a great deal of credit for recognizing so quickly after the 1997 financial crisis what was needed, opening the Korean economy, welcoming foreign investment. And again, that's a process that's not yet complete. But again, I think he's laid the basis for the very strong thrust of the new president's approach to the economy and international investment. Similarly, I think Nomi Yun deserves a lot of credit for cooperating with us in the process of modernizing updating our defense relationship. The changes that we were making, I think, represent ideas whose time has come. The process has not always been pleasant to look at, and we haven't always done the consultations we needed. But it seems to me we've again laid the basis for a stronger relationship in the future through the modernization of the alliance and the defense relationship. And I think Nam Hyun deserves a great deal of credit for negotiating, for teeing up the FTA. I think we're all poised to try to knock that ball down the path, but you know, we've got a lot of work to do on the U.S. side. So here we are. We do have an opportunity to move forward with new presidents in both countries. I think we're all very encouraged by the thrust of President Lee's approach to the relationship, approach to politics and to the world. We look forward very much to working with him as we try to thread our way through the some of the issues that Mike has laid out. I think a crucial step, as he suggests, is I think there are two really crucial elements. One is getting our act together on North Korea, moving forward together and expanding, restoring the trilateral cooperation that we have had in the past with Japan, South Korea, and the U.S. on North Korea. And the other, of course, is moving forward on the free trade agreement. I think it would be a tremendous shame if we failed to avail ourselves of the opportunity to broaden the U.S.-ROK alliance, to actually improve the terms in which we in the United States carry out our trade with South Korea, to contribute to the continued opening of the Korean economy, and finally to reinforce our regional position. The FTA is important not only bilaterally but strategically in an era when the United States does not play the dominant role that it has in the past in East Asia, where there are other major players like China, Japan, Russia, India that need to be taken into account. Having that economic alliance with the ROK cannot help but strengthen our position in a very dynamic region. Thank you.
Thank you for those excellent comments. I don't know anybody who's worked longer and more effectively and more with more expertise and skill on the Korean Peninsula than the gentleman seated to the far left. And let me invite David Straub now to make a few comments.
Thank you, Evans. The closeness of two nations and their cooperation depends, I think, fundamentally on whether they share interest and also how close the peoples of the two countries are. And in some ways, that closeness factor is even more important because, while some people say that interests are eternal, or in fact, interests are interpreted by the people who are in power and who make the decision. And there can be radically different interpretations of a nation's interest depending upon who's in charge. And so it's very important that the peoples and especially the leaders of two countries understand each other well. In doing research for this project, we were able to uncover a lot of interesting facts and figures, which usually are not focused on in terms of people-to-people ties. So, for example, there are 2 million, roughly, Americans of Korean descent or Korean residents in the United States. 750,000 Koreans visit the U.S. each year. We have well over 100,000 Korean students and exchange people coming to the United States every year, which is by far more than from any other country, including India and China. And my back-of-the-envelope calculation showed that about 3 million Americans in uniform have served in Korea since 1950. And, of course, Korea being the United States' seventh largest trading partner, we have tremendous business ties as well. So we do have an unusually large amount of people-to-people to ties. But there are many other but there are also a lot of indications that we could do a lot better. For example, in 2002, when we had this tragic accident, the death of the schoolgirls killed by a USFK vehicle, we Americans were essentially clueless as to why there was such a strong reaction. And similarly, last year when there was this tragic shooting at Virginia Tech, I was living in Korea at the time, and almost all Koreans were clueless as to what the reaction in the United States would be. So we have a lot to learn from each other, and we have made a number of recommendations in this report in terms of people-to-people ties. I'm sure we missed some other ones, but I really hope that our leaders in both countries, in both new administrations, will put more focus on this than we have in the past. We are happy that President Bush last year personally committed to trying to include Korea in the visa waiver program as soon as possible. It looks like that will probably happen late this year, maybe next year, and that will be an important step in itself. But we also hope that some of these other recommendations will be looked at.
Thank you very much, David. Let me now open the floor up for questions. If you could please identify yourself as you ask questions. There's a microphone that will be going around. And please do ask your question in the form of a question. Thank you. The floor is open. And this being April 15th, we are not giving out income tax advice. Start here, then we'll come over here.
Start the questioning. My name's Nick Brad. I'm a director of the Korea Society and also with Lazard Asset Management. I wonder if members of the panel would care to comment on the rather unhelpful rhetoric that we're getting from the two Democratic presidential candidates on free trade and protectionism.
I think your question phrased the answer.
Just remove the question mark.
I personally, regardless of which candidate or party I might support, I feel we're seeing a lot of unhelpful pandering. And as Mike suggested in his comments, trade is important. It's the essence of what we are and what we do. And it sure would be nice if we could have a healthy public debate among politicians about this critical question. But the election time probably is not the best time for that.
There's a tremendous dumbing down of public discussion of trade. And it's a great tragedy because no country benefited more than we. Not least because it spurs our own competitiveness. And so I despair listening to politicians talk about this. I thought David Brooks' column in the Times this morning was right on mark. The unions have done a pretty good job of persuading candidates in the Democratic Party that trade is the cause of all our difficulty. It isn't. And it can be statistically demonstrated rather easily. It's what we all learned in Economics 101. But somehow the currency of discussion has been so depreciated that it's rare to find politicians standing up just as a matter of course defending free trade. Free trade is the ideology of the strong. And if the strong don't defend it, who's going to defend it? So I'm delighted to see the Koreans taking this step because it illustrates that the Korean public is aware of the strength of their position. And I wish we could learn something from that. But I despair listening to politicians. I'm glad at least there are a few that are still willing to stand up for free trade. But until the nomination for the Democratic Party is settled, I don't expect that to happen. And once it is settled, there'll be a lot of commitments that have been made on the public record that'll be hard to disavow. I particularly worry about Mrs. Clinton. And I'll say this because I'm not a Democrat, so I don't have to worry about what anybody says. But my feeling is, you remember in 1992, when Bill Clinton came to office, the big issue that the administration faces is where do we put our priorities? It is the big issue a new administration faces. You get a certain amount of political capital. There's a supposition you either use it or lose it. So what do we use it for? And there was a big debate. Mrs. Clinton wanted to use it on health care, and that tended to have the highest priority. And she mucked that up. There was a vice president, Mr. Gore, who wanted to devote the attention to reinventing government. George Bush had presented the NAFTA agreement. And so there were some who said, we've got to get this ratified. And Bill Clinton, to his credit, took that on rather courageously and got it done. It was a difficult political task, and it got done, and we have benefited hugely. Our trade with Canada and Mexico is now $700 billion more than it was when NAFTA was negotiated. How people can go around and knock NAFTA as though it were self-evidently the cause of our difficulties is beyond me. It's counterintuitive and counterfactual. But my point would be that Mrs. Clinton fought giving any priority to NAFTA ratification in 1992, and she's on the record so explicitly on this matter, on trade issues, that to expect that this would be a priority in her administration, I think, is blowing smoke. So I truly worry. Mr. Obama hasn't been much better, but I think his public remarks seem aimed at preserving a greater measure of flexibility on this. The only two heartening episodes in this campaign, as far as I'm concerned on trade, have been the fact that Obama's advisor was going to the Canadians saying, don't pay any attention to what we say in public. And her campaign manager was quietly going to the Colombians, arranging to help cooperate in getting the Colombian trade agreement. So I don't know. If the only things that are heartening are the things that get people fired from the campaign, that's not a good sign.
If I add one more point, I think South Korea will ratify FTA, you know, if not next month, but I think in June when the first session of the incoming assembly will meet. But I'm skeptical that U.S. can do that, at least this year. And that means there will be some damage, and especially our reputation, not only in Korea, but maybe in Asia or other parts of the world, will be hurt. And that's why I was arguing for optimism with caution, because it's not an easy issue, and that might happen. So,
there was a gentleman on the right who had a question. Maybe not. Okay, then we'll come back over here. Why don't you wait for the mic, Mike?
Michael Ranieri, I'm with the Korea Center for Asia, for Korea Center for International Finance. Part of my job is to collect information about how U.S. investors feel about Korea. And so I get into discussions with regard to FDI and portfolio investment. And a couple issues that have been coming up since President Lee came to office or took office, one having to do with the Chaebols and the extent to which he would like to see Chaebols invest in financial institutions. That worries many U.S. investors. And there's still a concern, I would have to say, with regard to any anti-foreign sentiment that might exist in Korea with respect to more foreign investment coming in, particularly into the financial sector. And I guess the other issue that is of some concern is the one having to do with the canal project. There are some investors, particularly on the fixed income side, here in the United States, that worry that President Lee and his administration may spend too much on a project like that. So I don't know whether this came up in your research, but I'm wondering if any of you might be prepared to talk about those kinds of issues that are percolating here within the financial community.
Well, I think on all three of those issues, the jury's still out. We have seen suggestions from the president and his other advisors that there may be some loosening on of current restrictions preventing cross investment, et cetera, within and among the Chaebol and into the financial sector. And if definite decisions have been made on that, I haven't heard it yet. And I think a lot has been awaiting the result of the National Assembly election. In fact, that's something that none of us have mentioned and happened after we put out this report. But it strikes me that he got a very strong working majority in the Assembly, although, you know, the voter turnout was light, and you know, Obviously, he still faces some problems within his own party that may hamper him. But it looks to me like that Lee Myung-buk is going to be better able to carry out his policies than any president we've seen in recent memory. And that has to – so we have to take seriously his views on these things. I think all of this applies to the canal project as well. I was in Seoul as ambassador when MB Lee was elected mayor of Seoul, and he said he was going to change that incredible traffic roundabout in front of City Hall into a park. And I said, he's got to be smoking pot or something. He can't do that. And then he said he was going to tear down this overhead highway and turn it into a canal where people could take pleasant walks. And I had the same reaction to that, and it happened. So I tend to take seriously, when this president says he's going to build something, I take it seriously. But there are a lot of questions about still to be answered, I think, about the feasibility and support for it. And then finally, I think, this is an administration that warmly, totally welcomes foreign investment and is looking very hard at how to make that investment possible. But frankly, I think there's still a lot of public sentiment in Korea that is suspicious of foreign investment. We've seen in the Lone Star case and others how national sentiment can sometimes override good policy, how overzealous regulators can often override the policy wishes of the senior levels of government. So I think foreign investors are still going to have to take very seriously into account and have strategies aimed at making sure that their investments not only fit the rules, but they're also presented in such a way that they can be accepted by the Korean public. I think that is very possible to do.
So now tells me that on balance, American investors feel that President Lee presents an improvement over the past administration. I mean, they have concerns, like I said, but it is an improvement.
Yeah.
They feel more confident that this president will be better able to manage the economy going forward.
Let me just make three additional points, if I could, beyond what Ambassador Harbaugh said. Number one, to echo a point that he made, the policies of this new government still are very much a work in progress, everything from domestic economic policy to North Korea policy. Like every new administration, including American administrations, it will probably take a few months before we have real clarity on critical policy issues. Number two, I would suggest that you look carefully at how many investment-related events or events involving outreach to the U.S. business community are on President Lee's calendar on this visit. Quite a few of them, including three in New York City alone, quite frankly. Yeah, so there's clearly an emphasis, not just a rhetorical emphasis that you've been referring to in statements that have been made to date by the president, but in what he's trying to do on the ground here in the United States to follow up on this perception of a positive and receptive attitude towards investment with some serious work on the ground here in the United States. And the third point I would just make regarding the outcome of the National Assembly election, it is certainly true that there is a very comfortable conservative majority in the National Assembly now. However, and this is an important caveat, as you saw in the run-up to that vote and as you saw in the immediate aftermath of that vote, there are conservatives and then there are conservatives in the Republic of Korea. And you have some very interesting divisions among the conservative camp on a number of issues. And there's going to be we'll see a lot of sharp elbows, I think, in the next several months among the various players.
both those who are in the GMP aligned with the president, those in the GMP are aligned with Madame Pacone, those on the outside of the GMP but in the conservative camp tilting towards Yiwei Chang, and others as well. So some opposition and some criticisms of some of the president's programs have been expressed by members of the conservative camp, and I think that will have an effect on things like the canal project and some other things going forward. So this is still very much a work in progress. We had a question right here. Don?
I'm Don Zagoria from the National Committee on American Foreign Policy. First of all, I want to congratulate the Korea Society and the Shorenstein Center. This is a terrific report. The panel has been offering some very, very cogent observations. I want to try to get the discussion back to North Korea. Now, we're all at a disadvantage because we don't know exactly the deal that Chris Hill has apparently just made with Kim Gi-won.
That includes us, too.
Welcome to our world.
But reading between the lines in the newspapers and hearing from some of my more hawkish friends and gathering that Chris Hill testified before Congress and there were some problems there, it sounds as if the Bush administration is prepared to do something than accept, than insist on a full declaration from North Korea. They're going to acknowledge our concerns on Syria and uranium, and we're going to concentrate on plutonium and so on. And the people in favor of this say, well, you can't expect more at this stage from North Korea. Let's think about the future. This is better than where we've been. The people against it think that North Korea is back to its old games and so on. Now, I'd like to hear the panel react to this potential for a kind of Shanghai agreement style deal with North Korea, in which they acknowledge our concerns but do not come fully clean on Syria and uranium.
I didn't volunteer any comments because I generally don't like to comment on agreements whose details I haven't seen. And if I were in Congress, I wouldn't wish to approve an agreement whose details I hadn't seen. I don't quite understand how the Shanghai communique applies to this. The North Koreans are supposed to issue a declaration, which becomes the basis for denuclearization. They seem to be saying, you make the declaration, and we won't criticize it. But we know from past experience, our intelligence is highly imperfect on these matters, to say the least. So how can the U.S. intelligence come up with an assessment of North Korea's nuclear status? I don't believe it's possible. And so I think the onus should be on the North Koreans to provide a declaration. That's their obligation. It's not our place to make assertions on their behalf. Meanwhile, verification has been a concern that's been kind of pushed into the background. But this is a country that has practiced secrecy and deception to a fairly well throughout its whole life as a regime. And therefore, it's inconceivable to me that you can have an understanding on this sensitive an issue that isn't verifiable. But how can you verify your own intelligence assumptions rather than have some access to fortify confidence in an agreement when mistrust is so pervasive? So I'm very skeptical about selling an agreement. I approve of capping the plutonium program. It seems to me a regulated plutonium arrangement is better than an unregulated one. That's what we lived with for 5 years. And getting a cap back on is better than nothing, even though it's less good than having that cap at a lower level as it existed until 2002. So I approve of the progress that has been made in closing down the plutonium program, at least where it stood. Sig Hecker out at Stanford seems to be confident that the dismantling at Yongbyon has been very effectively implemented, and that any effort to reestablish a functioning plant there would be a very time-consuming affair because it's apparently gone to great lengths. So that's something which I take satisfaction. And I suspect the North Koreans, watching our politics, are probably playing a waiting game. They can sense a certain desperation on the part of the Bush administration to burnish some legacy on this issue. They didn't certainly want to leave a totally unregulated situation where they could be blamed for it. But when you get into that kind of circumstance, your negotiating partners tend to wait you out, let's see what else we can get. It's not a very comfortable position to be in as a negotiator. So I would assume that they have a kind of heads we win, tails you lose kind of a deal, because they can wait and see what else the administration is willing to offer, recognizing if they don't get anything, maybe the next administration will be even more generous. At least that's a calculation they might make, since their negotiating behavior over five decades has been one of exploiting time to their advantage. And nobody's better at stalling techniques. And so my own sense is that it's very important to keep the process going, especially now that the U.S. and South Korean positions are more readily coordinated. But let's not make a big mistake on the way to keeping the process going. But I say all that with a certain amount of discomfort because I haven't a clue what's going on in Syria. I haven't a clue what we know about enriched uranium. And I haven't a clue what Chris Hill has said to the North Koreans.
I think I, as usual, agree with almost everything Mike has said and almost all of his emphasis. But I think I would put somewhat more strength and emphasis on shutting down the plutonium program than you have, Mike. I have always felt that in negotiations with North Korea, you know, we need to stand firm, stand by principle, but we also need to be pragmatic. This is a very difficult regime to deal with, and frankly, we're bigger than they are and stronger than they are. So I think it is quite a merit to you know, complete the disablement, so that we can move on to dismantlement. I have more confidence in our intelligence on North Korea's plutonium program than I do on almost anything else in terms of U.S. intelligence, because thanks to the agreed framework that I helped negotiate, we had IAEA monitors in North Korea for a long period of time. We've had people like Sig Hecker going in there. I think we have a pretty good grasp of the plutonium, and I think the North Koreans are willing to own up to that. I feel far less confident in our intelligence about the uranium enrichment program, and frankly, I have no idea what was going on in Syria. I've been out of government throughout that time, but you know, I think I've always felt that we ought to bag what we can with North Korea, and not let the best prevent us from taking the good when we see it. And I think shutting down this plutonium program is very good. And I am uneasy about all of the rest of this. But this may well be a juncture where we have to be more pragmatic.
I was director of the State Department's Korean Affairs Office from 2002 to 2004. And it's been interesting to see how many of the basic policy positions of the Bush administration in its first term on North Korea have been almost completely reversed during the second term. So when Assistant Secretary of State Hill a few days ago said our main focus is on taking care of the plutonium program, well, I agree with that
in
principle, as a practical matter, that is completely different than the position of the Bush administration even a few months ago. If the reports about the agreement or consensus between the U.S. and North Korea are correct regarding uranium enrichment and nonproliferation, clearly all that will have done is finesse the problem temporarily. At some point, the U.S. and North Korea will have to engage in further negotiations to actually determine the full scope of what North Korea was doing and make basically so that we can have more confidence that those activities will not reoccur in the future. So if the media reports are correct, I guess I am reluctantly supportive of something like that because it's probably the best we can do at the time that will allow the process to continue and be passed on to the next U.S. administration in not too many months from now, and perhaps allow some additional progress in disabling and dismantling the Yongbyon facilities.
I don't have very much to add other than just to note that if this current emphasis on focusing on the plutonium issue in the administration had been the driving force behind our policy in October of 2002, we wouldn't be dealing with an extra 30 or 40 kilograms of plutonium today. But we are where we are. And let's keep in mind that it was the uranium enrichment issue that got us into this crisis a few years ago. And getting out of this crisis will require something fairly substantial on the uranium enrichment issue today. And I don't know, based on the press reports I've seen, if what's out there is enough, quite frankly. I'm not going to dismiss what came out of Singapore as being not valuable. I think it was useful. But my sense is that we're going to need a bit more than what I've seen so far coming out of Singapore, particularly in the area of ensuring that the things that we do know about their uranium enrichment-related efforts are accounted for. Our intelligence may not be as great as we would like it to be in certain areas, but there are certain things that we do know about what the DPRK acquired. And where they got it from and even how much they paid for it. And somehow we're going to have to, as part of this process, achieve closure on that issue in particular.
Let me go back here.
My name is Y.D. Kim. I'm the board member of the Korea Society. I'd like to go back to FTA issue. Beef issue has been one of the most difficult one. I think that's not included in FTA agreement, I understand. I think last couple of weeks I noticed there has been very intense negotiations going before President Lee left Korea. And I'm working closely with grassroots group to support this FTA, and we have been counting numbers from the Republicans, Democrats. And from your study in FTA, do you think if beef problem is resolved, do you think we have a practically good chance to pull through FTA?
I don't count votes in Washington, but I remember that in 1992, when NAFTA was passed along to the Clinton administration, by fall of 93, it wasn't moving too well, and the administration realized they had to mount a really serious effort to get ratification. That meant identifying the votes they needed and generating the kind of pressures in each state or each district that a congressman would respond to. And I think you'll find on trade matters you get a different discussion of these issues when you get out into the countryside, particularly in districts that benefit from trade, and most do. Or many do. So I think it's going to take a kind of a major campaign to identify the votes needed and to generate pressures from the grassroots up on congressmen to get it done. And unfortunately, that's not the kind of planning that people focus on when the debate is at this high, abstract, and kind of silly, trivial level that it's taken during the campaign. But I think the grassroots support is probably the critical element in putting together the kind of coalition that can produce the votes. I think it can be done, but an administration has to put its mind to it and put a lot of effort into it.
I think, you know, one thing we have to think about is the timing. I think timing is very crucial. And in this case, I'm afraid that timing is not right, because now, if South Korea ratified already FTA, and then maybe during this visit, you know, Mr. Lee resolved this beef issue, then it might put certain pressure and, you know, create certain momentum for ratification in the United States. But none of them has happened. And as you know, fairly soon we are getting into politics, I mean, seasonal politics in the United States. I mean, that's why, in terms of timing-wise, it's not, you know, too good. So, I mean, that's why I'm still kind of skeptical that this will go through this year. And, you know, the timing is, once again, quite unfortunate, yeah.
I think Giewoek may be right, and it's certainly the case that you're not going to build public support for this until the general election, because you haven't got there's nobody arguing the case in the primary fight on the Democratic side. So if it's true that during the general election a candidate makes a strong case for free trade, then you might establish the predicate for doing it later. I was hoping it could be done in September, sometime after the conventions, but I can't dismiss Giewoek's contention that the atmospheric and the political schedule aren't very inviting.
Let me just quickly add, I'm not involved in vote counting in Washington, but I am very active in a coalition in favor for supporting the FTA being managed by at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And I think what we've seen is that, you know, trade is like a third rail. Nobody on Capitol Hill wants to look at a trade agreement until he or she actually has to do so. And the fact that the beef problem remains has really prevented any serious effort on the Hill to push this thing forward. So your question, if beef is fixed, can we get it approved? I think I have to turn it around. Unless beef is fixed, we have no chance of moving forward at all. And so I do hope that that occurs over the next few days.
This reminds me, I've got to recheck the menu for the dinner this evening at the Plaza tonight to make sure that beef is indeed on it.
Let me come right beef from Korea.
Alexander Ilyichev, Political Department, United Nations Secretariat. Well, in some place, today is the day of sun, but in New York, it seems to me the day of the Korea Society. Powerful beginning with your panel report and the promising event in the evening. So congratulations. Now, about the recommendations to U.S. Policymakers, whoever wishes to take this task, to advise President Bush. So President Lee is coming to Washington and Camp David with open hands, with the true determination to show that he is the best friend the U.S. has in the peninsula these days, a long time. Fine. I'm glad that this dichotomy was detected by you, Ambassador Amakos, that while the U.S. is really focusing, and I agree with you, the most important it seems to keep the process going, just to get step by step to our shared goal of non-nuclear peninsula, we see I would say, more than expected deterioration in the inter-Korean relations. We all knew that something would be different, but nobody predicted, that it would go with such speed. Of course, nobody knows whether it's the adjustment, the testing time, and nobody. But we don't want to see the worst-case scenario when, while moving the DPRK-US track on the nuclear issue and other things, because we all know that what nuclear issue involves, see suddenly the inter-Korean track, instead of complementing the first one, basically, at best, not supporting it in reality, and at worst, maybe even damaging it and slowing it down. So given that President Bush is going to see the real friend, and what would be your advice to President Bush? Should he discuss this dichotomy, in which way? So just to synchronize, as you said, this working together. Thanks.
I am still one of those old-fashioned guys who thinks when leaders get together, they ought to discuss the serious problems. And so, of course, they should. And they should seek to synchronize. It doesn't seem to me that insisting upon a measure of reciprocity should damage relations unless one party expects always to receive and never to give in the relationship. And I don't see how you can sustain a relationship for long on that basis. So my understanding of President Lee's position is that he's for engagement. He's willing, in fact, to do more, but expects at least some reciprocity. And that seems to me reasonable. It's difficult because for years, North Korea has come to expect a different kind of arrangement. And so there's necessarily a kind of weaning process, I suppose. It can be unpleasant. But I wouldn't draw any conclusions at this point because this is only a matter of a couple of months' experience. We've seen the North Korean react rhetorically. What its real reaction is, I'm not smart enough to figure out. But I don't believe it's unreasonable to expect, if you're building a durable relationship, to expect some give as well as some get. And that's all I think he's asking.
You know, yesterday in D.C., you know, one of the panelists said that the story about Mr. Lee's visit has been written already. It's like success in a story. And, you know, until now, I see a lot of rhetoric and symbolism. And obviously, the first visit, you know, you don't want to go wrong. So obviously, you have to make it, you know, successful. But having said that, you know, I totally agree with Mike because you have to confront tough issues. Otherwise, you know, this will have to come up sooner or later. And if you just avoid and just rely on symbols and rhetoric, I think that that can be a problem. So if I had a chance to advise Mr. Bush, at least in private talks, should talk seriously and you know, carefully. So
one of the central recommendations of this report is the need for enhanced coordination and very frank exchanges on all the issues. And so I would second what my colleagues have said about the need for that. I'm sure it didn't escape the notice of anybody in this room that almost literally at the very moment that Ambassador Hill and his delegation were sitting down in Singapore trying to achieve some progress on the issues that were barring progress in the six-party talks, the relationship between North and South Korea was heading in a very uncomfortable direction and contributed, I think, to, if not a poisoning of the atmosphere, it created a very difficult atmosphere literally at the same moment that the United States was trying to make progress in this issue. So it seems to me, at a minimum, one of the issues on the table at Camp David later on this week ought to be the need to make sure that we get our approaches on a better and more coordinated track so that we aren't running the risk of undercutting each other. I think we have time for one more question, so why don't we go. This gentleman, you had your hand up earlier, so let me go here.
Thank you. Many Koreans are quite pleased that
the you tell us your name and your affiliation, please.
My name is Jay Jang. I'm just former Army officer working as a strategic planner, Combined Forces Command, and also I'm now in Kennedy School at Harvard University. Just my question is just actually many Koreans are quite pleased that the United States could welcome President Lee very exceptionally, quite, you know, highly. But also many Koreans also worried, but there should be some cost. It's probably money issue. And the money issue probably list a couple of things, including trade issue, but also some budget sharing of the military relocation, those things. So there have been long discussion about that. My senior officer, General Ahn, was, of course, just handled that issue long time. So my question to you is, do you have any particular framework or guidelines to recommend to President Lee to promote the actual alliance issue? And also, probably you probably have guidelines or recommendation to President Bush and also probably new President, you know, United States, for those guidelines as a facilitator to promote both countries' issue fairly, if you have.
Let me ask David Straub to answer that, and others may want to chime in as well. But let me just also point out the presence of General Ahn in our audience today, who is a counterpart of mine in the base-related negotiations and some of the most important progress that we made in modernizing the U.S.-ROK defense relationship and our base presence in Korea were due to the progress that we made, and largely thanks to his leadership there. David?
The Korean media in the last few days has been focusing on this theme that the U.S. government may be expecting too much of President Lee and may be pressing him to do too many things at once. I personally think that many of the things that the Korean media has raised as bad things are actually not bad things, but are probably good things for both the United States and South Korea, including everything from South Korea paying a little bit more of the cost of the U.S. military presence in South Korea to inclusion of South Korea in the Proliferation Security Initiative. These things can be political problems, and leaders need to take these into account, even if they don't themselves necessarily believe that there's a substantive problem there. So in our report, we've taken note of this and recommended that that the leaders talk carefully about what their priorities are. And I hope that President Bush and President Lee, they're going to have many hours of discussions. I hope that they have a full and frank discussion of the major issues that each leader sees and tries to at least roughly come up with a priority list so that we don't try to do everything at once, thus resulting in problems for everything, but we try to focus on the most important things first and also take into account what is feasible.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for coming here today. And just a final couple of words regarding this report and the panel. As you see from the list of participants in the back of the book, we had a group of very distinguished people with a very broad range of political views. But there were several things in which there was an absolute unanimity of opinion among every one of the panelists, including all of the ones who are not here today and not able to be with us. And that was on the importance of the U.S.-ROK relationship and on the fact that the best days of that relationship are yet to come and that there are tremendous things that we are going to be able to do in the future if we put our energy and our minds and our skills to it. This is a critically important relationship. It is more important than it ever has been in the past. And I think that's recognized by the fact that the President of the Republic of Korea is going to be treated in the way that he's going to be treated this week. And I think we are off to a very, very good start. And we at the Korea Society, and I know my colleagues from Stanford, the Shorenstein Center, are delighted to have been a part of putting out a report literally on the eve of the President's visit that I think we will contribute, to the overall atmosphere. If you could please join me in thanking my fellow panelists for being here today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Journal. Membership may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.